We're starting the Mystic Pete Chronicles. Here's some kabuki music. Starting the Mystic Pete Chronicles, and I'm Mystic Pete. Every week, through interviews with thought leaders, visionaries, and creatives, and stories, music, and humor, we'll do some deep ponders in this time of great change and have some fun. If you'd like more information about today's guests or to be interviewed for the show yourself, I'm at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. In today's show, I interview the beloved Catherine Free, longtime Loyola Marymount University professor, now retired, and KXLU radio host. We started the show with kabuki music by Ensemble Nipponia called The Pine Tree at Ataka, Ataka no Matsu. And this is to get us warmed up for the very interesting interview I did with Catherine Free about Japanese theater. So stay tuned. Mystic Pete Chronicles. January 26th, 2024. Mystic Pete here with Catherine Free. And we are in our third edition. And we are going to talk today about theater and perhaps Asian theater, Japanese theater. Yeah. And this, we'll start there and go and see what happens.
Well, I love the Japanese theater. I've taught it many times. I have seen a lot of it. I do not speak Japanese, so I cannot call myself, you know, a profound scholar of the Japanese theater. I have, over the years, made a study of it in the English language. I've read many, many texts about the Japanese theater by people who are expert in the Japanese language, and translations of plays. And I've seen as many performances as possible everywhere that I have been. And happily, the Japanese theater, the traditional theater forms of Japan, do leave Japan and come to the United States periodically. And also contemporary Japanese theater leaves Japan and comes to the United States. So I've been able to appreciate the living performance, which is where you really learn to love an art form, by seeing it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's something a lot of Westerners are not familiar with. I'm generally aware of kabuki and no, and also a more modern form called buto. I just happened to be involved with a guy named Oguri who did buto in Los Angeles, but it's a little bit more obscure.
I saw Senjai Juko
in
Los Angeles with a buto company also. So, okay. Yeah.
Well, why don't we start at the beginning for people listening? And you used to teach this, so this is why we're
right,
focusing
why
on
we're,
these.
We're reminiscing about Japanese theater. Well, it's one of the oldest continuously performed kinds of theater in the world. And in terms of the major forms of theater of the world, maybe the oldest.
Starting when?
What I wanted to talk about were some dance forms which go back to the 7th century AD and came from China originally during the Tang Dynasty, when Japan had a great interest and an opening, a flowering of interest in Chinese culture. In fact, the Japanese emperor even went to the Tang court and lived there many years. Hmm. But the art form, so it came from Japan, from China, and also from the Korean peninsula. And this was a dance form called gagaku. It's got an association with the imperial court, the court of the Japanese emperor. And it really is rarely seen outside of court circles.
So it's a courtly form.
Yes, it is partly masked. Sometimes the characters are masked. And it has a dramatic context, usually. It can be based on a poem that has some kind of dramatic feeling about maybe a battle that has been fought or a love story that has been told. So there is a dramatic element to it, although it's not theater in the sense that other forms of Japanese theater are definitely theatrical and tell a drama from beginning to end.
So this goes back a long time.
This goes back very long, and it was more dramatic, apparently, in telling stories in its oldest forms. But it gradually lost that aspect of itself and became more pure dance.
I see. Well, in Europe at this time, you know, the best theater was probably in the local bar, people drunk and singing a tune, but here in Japan it was more
Well, 7th century AD, I mean, there wasn't much going on theatrically in the West. Yeah. You know, Greek drama had pretty much disappeared.
That's it.
Roman
Maybe
drama.
In Middle East. But,
yeah. In Japan must have been, along with China and Korea at that time, you know, major centers in the world for any kind of performance art. One thing that appeals to me greatly about all the Japanese forms is that it's an amalgam of dance, drama, storytelling, enactment of a character, and also music. So, which the Japanese culture has, a superb sense of design. So that the arts are all one. They're together. And, of course, that appeals to me as a person tremendously, because that's what Greek drama was. It was a complete combined art form of music, dance, drama. And unfortunately, the music is lost, the choreography is lost, but it was very much a major part of the art form in its performance in antiquity. So I knew that, and I was attracted to Japanese theater because it has that same principle that all of the arts are one and that you use them all in the performance. And so I thought it could teach me something that maybe I could apply to Greek drama. And I'm not the only one that has been thinking this way, because there's a wonderful application of Japanese performance techniques and style to Greek drama that is also carried by both Japanese contemporary practitioners and also some very fine avant-garde directors and acting teachers and artists in the West. And so there is a real affinity there. You can learn something from a living art form like a very ancient Japanese form. Gagaku is still alive. It's still performed really only at the Japanese court, but it was brought to Los Angeles in 1984 for the Olympic Arts Festival by Robert Fitzpatrick, who at that time was president of CalArts. And it was an incredible experience. Very, very, very still, very slow. The music is very, very long notes drawn out. And it has a fairly large orchestra. It has sacred drums, which actually are divinities of some sort.
Shamanistic?
Yes, which they brought from Japan for this incredible experience in Los Angeles. So I got to see Gagaku, and I was able to understand its relationship to a more recent form, but still very ancient, which is the no drama. And that's really the one of the oldest continuously performed forms of drama in the world, the no drama, which is N-O-H, or N-O with a long mark over the O. It doesn't mean nothing or no way or anything of those in English. It is an incredibly refined art form, which is basically a dance drama with a chorus which sings most of the dramatic lines of the play, and sometimes not only narrates the background of the story, as most choruses do, but also speaks the lines of the protagonist.
Well, similar to Greek.
The protagonist is performed by a dancer who never, if ever, I mean, very, very rarely, if ever, speaks. Maybe makes a sound, but not really a word. And that is the main performer of the entire piece, is a dancing actor who does not speak, is mute, but the chorus speaks for that character. And it's performed with a kind of music that comes out of Buddhist chant, Japanese Buddhist chant. It also is linked to China, in the sense that Zen Buddhism had come from China at about the same time that the no was going to develop. So there's a very strong philosophical and religious influence from Zen Buddhism in the texts of No Drama. And the No Drama, it arose from two strains then in Japanese performance art. One was a kind of comic skit with dancing and singing, which was called Sarugaku, which was very popular, like pop theater, you know, like a concert that you might go to as a kid now. And also from the Gagaku, the courtly dance performance, which could be seen through another manifestation of it called Bugaku, which is seen in Shinto temples by the public. Otherwise, the public would never be allowed to see Gagaku, which was strictly a court experience. But Bugaku brings a lot of the same aesthetics of Gagaku to a wider audience. And that influenced the development of the No Theater in its dance forms and in its musical forms. There was a genius, the creator, or two geniuses, that created the No Drama from these strains of things. And they were Kanami, a man named Kanami, who was a performer, a dancer, and his son, Zayami, who was apparently a great dancer and caught the attention of the shogun, the ruler of Japan, in this Muromachi period in the 14th century. One of the greatest of all shoguns, Ashigawa Yoshimitsu. And Zayami and he became lovers. And so he became the patron of this new art form that father and son were developing. Hmm. And Zayami was a master playwright. Some of the greatest masterpieces of medieval Japanese literature are the plays he wrote for the No Theater. And they're in a language which can no longer be easily understood by Japanese speakers.
Mm, like Shakespearean English.
Yeah, or like maybe even Chaucer's English. You know,
antique.
Well, that's about the same time span, isn't it? Chaucer's, what, 14th century too?
Yeah.
So, it is, these are great masterpieces, and they are treasures of Japanese culture, and they provide a tremendous window into the aesthetics of the same culture, the Muromachi period, that the tea ceremony, the famous Japanese tea ceremony, was developed. So the aesthetics of the No are derived really from that court dance, the Gagaku. Mm. And it begins with an introduction called a jo. And then there is a complication, or it's called a break in Japanese, a ha. And then it ends with a kyu, which is a very emotional and fast and rapid artistic expression. So there are three parts of every No play that Zayami created that form based on Gagaku form.
And it might go on for few hours, or?
Well, you know, the funny thing is that they think that the time that the performance of a No play would have taken in Zayami's time maybe was 30 minutes.
Oh, sure.
But now it's like an hour and a half or
okay.
something.
And not
because,
that long.
Because the performance style has slowed down. And that same thing has happened in Gagaku, only even more so because it's much older. Mm. So it seems that the older Japanese performance forms have slowed down into as they have reached the 21st century. So one short No play that would take you maybe 20 minutes to read and maybe a half an hour in Zayami's lifetime to perform now takes an hour and a half in performance, something like that.
So you can sit through it. It's not a marathon.
No, but it's very, very slow.
It's slow.
It's very slow.
A different sensibility than Western audiences are used to being goosed.
Well,
every
I think
2 minutes.
We have very short attention spans now. And people are complaining about Oppenheimer at 3.5 hours.
And we need a joke or a murder every 2 or 3 minutes.
That's right. Or something has to blow up. That's right.
Well, I understand my very limited knowledge that the training for one of these masters could go on for years, and it's extremely demanding, wearing a very tight mask and very heavy
layers
of clothes.
Yes, now the masks are incredible, and they are, the leading actor is called the Shite. He is a dancer, he does not speak, but he is the leading performer of the piece. And usually there is the first part, Joe, is very, very, very slow. And in that, a secondary actor known as a Waki, who wears no mask and no makeup, just a plain face and a rather simple costume, often he's represented as a monk. Someone who has lived a life, maybe as a warrior or in some other capacity, and now has resigned himself to spiritual exercises and to the life of being a monk. So, of course, the philosophy here is going to be Zen Buddhism. And so we're looking for enlightenment, right, in Buddhism. And in Zen Buddhism, that can happen at any moment. That's the point of the tea ceremony. That every moment is precious in the tea ceremony, because any moment can be a moment of enlightenment.
Mm, beautiful.
And so this Awaki, who is not wearing a mask and who is very resigned to the spiritual side of life, encounters someone. And that someone may be, say, an old woman who is weaving. And then that would be played by the Shite wearing a mask and a simple costume as an old.
All man performers, traditionally.
But they're all male performers, yeah. Thank you, yes. There were no actresses, but they were banned from the theater in the 17th century, also in Kabuki. But in the 21st century, women have started to perform no. They've been studying no for 50 years. Or more.
They're breaking in.
Ever since the end of World War II, women started studying no. And now there are troops of women that perform no. So this is a big change for no, that it's maybe a wonderful thing, in my opinion, that women get to perform some of these great art forms that otherwise were shut off from. But I've never seen a woman perform a no. I've only seen male performers. And the four main schools of no, which are hereditary. You can't decide, I'm 15 years old, I want to become a no actor and join a troupe.
It's family.
It's your father's tradition. He's handing on to you. You hand it on to your son. And it always excluded women for many, many, many centuries, up until fairly recently. But there are four main troupes of the no theater, and they are descended from the original groups that performed no in the time of Zayami. At any rate, this masked character, the Shite, the leading character, who maybe is an old woman wearing an old woman's mask, or maybe it's a young, beautiful girl, or maybe it's a young warrior, you know, something like that. Or maybe it's an elderly monk also, but wearing a mask, that person is transformed in the ha, which is the break, and goes off stage, up a ramp to the dressing room, changes their costume and mask, and comes back in their true self, because they were pretending to be this other thing, or maybe the other thing was a memory of what they used to be. Now they are a demon, or they are a ghost, or they are some other entity entirely. And that is shown in the mask, which if it's a demon, it's a demonic mask. If it's a ghost, it's clear from the mask what this person is. This person is trapped by the life they had lived. They had made some error or some committed some crime, or had lived a life that wasn't a good life, or maybe they were a warrior killed in the midst of battle, a young, handsome warrior. Now their spirit is angry and is reliving that moment where they were killed. And Buddhism is about escaping that, of not being trapped in one life or going on to another life, but achieving enlightenment, which is beyond human emotion. And so the monk, who is the secondary character, unmasked secondary character, is praying for the soul of this person who's trapped in this memory of how they died or what they had done. Maybe if it's a beautiful young girl, maybe she was cruel to her lovers.
So there's like a guardian angel.
Yes, she's not a guardian angel. She's an unhappy soul trapped.
The monk is
the monk is praying for her soul.
A guardian,
but he is alive. He's a living human being.
Right.
This other entity is not a living human being.
Gotcha. It's an archetype.
Yes. So it's a very wonderful spiritual quest that every no play reveals. And it also deals with the depths of human emotion, the depths of human depravity, of what are the bad things you can do with your life. And it deals with the theme of repentance, of escaping this, of rising above this terrible trauma that led you to this entrapment, spiritual entrapment.
So as all great theater portrays, it's not always about the happy people from the happy village.
No. If that happy person from that happy village appears in the jo, by the end of the play, the q, you know that that's a raging maniac who probably was a serial killer or something.
Wow. So it's deep. It's,
yes,
very,
it's very deep.
Psychological.
It's very deep. Yes, it is. It's a very profound art form. And the masks are great, great masterpieces of carving. They're wood, and they're carved out of wood. And because the shite doesn't speak, they don't have to worry about acoustics. And normally it's played in a fairly small audience because this is not popular with the masses. This is something for aficionados. It's got a limited appeal by its very nature. And it always did because it was taken over by the warrior class, the shogun, and the samurai were the devotees of the no drama. This is so it represents the values of that culture too, of the warrior caste of Japanese culture, which was there was the emperor and his court, which by the Muromachi period were just shadow figures. They were not real power brokers in Japan. The power was in the hands of the shogun, the most powerful of the leaders of the samurai. And all of the daimyo, the other lords who ruled various provinces of Japan, and their private armies, which were the samurai. And so this is a warrior caste, and the no drama represents the values of that caste. Zen Buddhism appealed to the warrior caste. And that's why the tea ceremony is developed by them and why the no drama is developed by them.
And so maybe very spare, very sparse, but there's a lot in the small movements.
Well, it's ironic because
Zen Buddhism, you know, it's very tight. It's not a flamboyant type of religion. You sit for hours.
It's a special kind of Buddhism.
Yeah.
You know, they're
you
different.
Sit and you shut up and deal with everything that's coming up.
In the no, there is this constant contact. It's very interesting because in the dance of the no, there's a constant contact with the earth. They perform on a wooden, beautifully polished wooden stage with a roof over it, which represented the outdoor kind of staging they would have done in a temple, for instance, or in the courtyard of a palace. And now all no theaters are roofed with probably very comfortable modern seating, but the stage remains covered by a roof, even though we're inside a building. and it has a ramp that leads from the stage to the dressing room. The stage is this beautiful polished wood, and the walk of the no actor, whether he's the waki or the shite or the shite's friend, who's called a suri and who also may be masked, is never to let your foot leave that floor. So it's a kind of gliding walk where you maybe raise your toes and you put them down and then you raise your heel. It's sort of like the moonwalk of Michael Jackson. Okay. It is. Only done much more slowly than Michael Jackson did it. What are the people up to? So, and where are the women? So we have a priestess in the city of Kyoto in a very exciting period of Japanese history, a transition period, the beginning of the Tokugawa shogunate, which is the last shogunate of Japan and begins around the time that Shakespeare was alive and working in London. So when Shakespeare's alive and writing his plays, there is this priestess in Kyoto who is creating in the riverbeds for the people, the commoners, the nobodies that the shogun and his samurai swordsmen would despise, a wonderful form of theater called kabuki. And so she created kabuki. She was a male impersonator. Her whole troupe was female, and they performed in the riverbeds. They performed dances. They performed songs. And they performed plays maybe taken from the no theater and put into more vulgar language, more contemporary language. Not great masterpieces of Japanese literature like the no plays are. And she got a huge attention, so much so that the shogun invited her to Tokyo to or Edo, as it was called then, to perform at his court, and that made her a sensation. But the difficulty was these were all beautiful young women in her troupe, and they're performing to a lot of men. So you can imagine how else they made money on the side after the show was over. And so that didn't go down very well with the authorities. So women in 1629 were banned from the kabuki theater. Mm. It was taken over by young boys.
This association with prostitution.
Yes. So then the kabuki was taken over by young, handsome boys. And what happens? The young boys start making a lot of money after the show's over too. And the shogun gets very upset about that, and they cancel them. So they gave it to adult men to perform. And the kabuki theater was created as we know it at that point, with an incredibly rich and marvelous female impersonation tradition called onagata. Basically three kinds of roles. You could play a warrior. And because this was the people's theater, who were the people? The people in the cities were the merchants who were actually quite well off financially. They were sort of like what the Jews were in the Middle Ages in Europe, because the warrior class was living high on the hog, but they needed money, right? But they weren't allowed to make money because it was considered demeaning and beneath the warrior to do that.
Same thing happened in Europe.
So the merchants were lending them money and getting very rich, and also trading and selling. But the shogun created laws, sumptuary laws, which did not allow these rich merchants to show their wealth in public. They were not allowed to wear silk kimonos. They were not allowed to carry two swords. Only the warrior class could carry two swords. They could carry one sword, but only two, not two. They were restrained in other ways as well. So this was their art form. It was definitely, if there's a hero, he's going to be that young merchant in the play who's handsome and darling and daring and who wears silk kimonos, but underneath his cotton kimono. So the outermost kimono is cotton, and the innermost one closest to his skin is a beautiful silk. And if a girl's going to fall in love with anybody in the play, it's not going to be with the nasty old samurai warrior. It's going to be with this handsome youth who's very charming merchant.
Interesting. And of course, now this is much more flamboyant and perhaps lured masks or...
It's much more flamboyant and much more popular music, was contemporary for its time. It reached its highest point in the 18th century. It never produced great drama, great literature. They took plays from wherever they could find them and just adapted them for their uses in the kabuki. It combines music, dance, and very flamboyant acting on the part, especially of the warriors in the play. That's called the arigato style. So these warriors are like people out of the Marvel comics. Their muscles bulge. Their faces are painted. They didn't have masks in the kabuki theater. They used face paint.
Right.
So for the warrior, they had a special kind of kumadori paint, which has a very white skin with red lines to represent the veins on his face standing out when he's doing battle or enraged against an enemy.
The dramatic makeup.
So it's very dramatic makeup, huge wigs, the swords are bigger than anybody in the world has ever seen that the warrior will wear. And frequently he's the villain. If there's a love story being played, he's the villain in that play. Because it's the young merchant who's going to get the girl, or who the girl and will fall in love with.
But here the actors are also dancing and singing. There's not
yes,
a chorus.
Yes, absolutely. And they had the Kabuki Theater was a theater that had a stage, not a great deal of scenery, but more scenery than the No Theater had for sure. And had two big ramps called hanamichis, which ran from the back of the theater to the stage. And these were made for the spectacular entrances, particularly of those warriors that I'm talking about. And they'll get maybe halfway down the ramp, and the music will stop, the action of the play stops. And the actor, there's kind of a rattle sound that the musicians make, and the actor will strike a big pose and then shake his hands maybe and cross his eyes, shake his head, and groan, and that's called a mie, where they stop everything. There's a star actor playing the warrior will strike one of these poses at the moment of, and if it's a serious drama, which there are plays that deal with serious topics. There's one about it's a true story actually. In a period of warring after the fall of the Muromachi, at the end of the Muromachi period, there were a lot of civil wars in Japan, and this lord was had a young son. The lord is defeated in battle. His army was defeated in battle by the enemy camp. And the enemy general was commanded by his lord to show him the head of the young boy who was going to be the heir to the other clan. And so he's also indebted to that lord that has been defeated, because he had done something or other, some kindness he had shown him at one time. So he doesn't want to kill this boy. So instead, the boy escapes, and now he has to show a head of someone to his lord to fulfill his obligation. So he takes his own son and kills him and presents his own son's head to his lord and master, the ultimate sacrifice. And he will strike a mie before he reveals that head, yes.
So
it can be an emotional thing too, a moment of terribly emotional tension. It can be Some of the plays are love stories that are unhappy love stories, Romeo and Juliet type love stories, where the young merchant is too poor to buy his girl out of her life as a geisha, and so he and she decide to commit suicide. And maybe there, she's being sold off to a horrible old samurai that she can't stand. So it's that sort of thing. Yeah, yeah. And in those plays, those are a second type of play. So you have warrior plays, like the one I had described. You have double suicides. You have suicides of young lovers who cannot be together in this life, but they think if they commit suicide together, they will be together forever in eternity. And also there are dances that are just classic dances which they've adapted to the kabuki style, which a leading, maybe onagata, will come out to perform.
Well, this mie you're talking about, I think Western audiences may be familiar, if they're watching anime, that there are these pauses. It's not necessarily like what you're talking about. It may be just the action stops and there's a scene of a grasshopper for a minute. I mean, it's just this feeling of we're stopping and we're just going to take a minute. Mm-hmm. And it shows up in even American films these days. I think it's been influenced. Like, we can take a moment before all hell breaks
loose. Yeah, before we blow up the building.
But it gives a frame, a picture frame to everything else that's going to happen.
I'm not familiar with anime, so I take your word for it. And there is...
It's in a different way.
There is a lot of wonderful stillness in all of these art forms, especially in the no, but less so in kabuki, which is a more vivid and emotional and popular kind of thing, meaning that it isn't as complex. You know, like, again, a Marvel comic, is as wonderful as it might be, it isn't that complex about human nature.
Yeah.
As, say, Chekhov or something like that.
Right.
But so the no drama is Chekhov. And the kabuki is more like a wonderful, flamboyant, popular art form.
I think one mistake that Western audiences can make about these ancient art forms is that they're dated or corny, or they're not going to deal with real intense subjects or be entertaining. But what was entertaining in the 15th century? It's the same thing. We go back to black and white film noir in the 40s and 50s. It's got to be compelling. Well, we have to be grabbed.
The no drama is like classical ballet, which was created at the courts of Europe, the courts of France in particular, the court of Louis XIV. And then throughout the 18th and 19th centuries, it continued to flourish. Yes, in public theaters. It did go to the public theaters. And famous dancers performed in public theaters. But it was still, for instance, in Russia, where it reached its greatest height in the early 20th century, it was related very closely to the imperial court.
Well, but my point is that what audiences found compelling in Sophocles' time, it's the same type of intensity and drama and conflict that people will find in 2024, maybe in a different medium. It's not going to be just like silly or corny or, I don't know.
Yeah.
We're still the same people.
We are. And that's what I feel when I read ancient Egyptian poetry. I'm reading a book now about ancient Sumerian poetry. Did you know that the first known author in the entire world was a woman?
Okay.
Her name is, I'm going to get this wrong, Enheduanna.
Sumerian.
Yes, was a woman.
Mm.
So I've been reading her poetry, and you read this stuff written thousands of years ago, and you realize that, well, the Greek poets are obviously that, thousands of years ago too, but not as old as Sumerian. But their feelings were no different from ours.
What grabbed an audience then grabs an audience.
That's right.
Different mediums.
Yeah.
But the same intensity and emotion and ideas and psychology.
So that's really what let me just finish to say that the kabuki had a great rival for popularity in the 18th century, 17th and 18th century, which was a wonderful puppet theater, the Bunraku, which exists now in only in Osaka. Is there a Bunraku professional company? But there's like one third life size puppets, and each puppet is worked by three puppeteers. And they're wonderful stories. They had a great playwright, the Shakespeare of Japan, Chikamatsu. And his plays were taken into the kabuki as well. And then another famous, as things actually happened, the latest suicides, the latest political intrigue, they would find their way into the theaters of both the Bunraku, the puppet theater, and the kabuki. In the hands of the Bunraku was in the hands of a great playwright, Chikamatsu. So that there's a very famous episode of Japanese history, it's a true story, about the 49 Ronin. Probably you've even seen Keanu Reeves in his version of that.
I've seen better versions.
Well, then there are Japanese versions. Well, it's a play by Chikamatsu. And he wrote that just with like maybe 6 months after the events actually occurred, in which a young lord is forced to commit suicide because he offended the chamberlain who works for the shogun.
Yes.
And in revenge, and then they disband his clan and they disband all of his samurai. And the samurai are masterless, which is what the Japanese word ronin means, that you have no master, but you're a warrior, with no master. And so 49 of these ronin that had served this lord had sworn within 1 year of his death to revenge themselves on the chamberlain, which they did by disguising their true intentions, becoming beggars, living in brothels, living disreputable lives, making the chamberlain go off guard so he would never suspect what they were going to do to him. And then one night, at the exact anniversary of their lord's suicide, they break into the chamberlain's house and kill him. But and everyone admires what they did. I mean, that's true samurai code, to be Bushido code, to avenge your lord's death is the finest thing a warrior can do. But they're forced to commit ritual suicide because, as a punishment, because they've killed the chamberlain. And so that was an outrage in the minds of ordinary Japanese people that they never forgot. And Chikamatsu wrote a wonderful play about it, which went into kabuki and is the basis of all the Japanese films and also Keanu Reeves' film.
Keanu Reeves, right.
I wanted to talk about the influence on the West. Everybody knows how important to someone like Matisse the discovery of Japanese prints was in his own work as an artist, and how closely they were studied by the artists of the late 19th, early 20th century, once Japan opened up to the West. And the Meiji Revolution happened, which led to the modernization of Japan. And so Japanese artists, performance artists, started traveling west too, a few. They influenced the development of the avant-garde in the West. So that, for instance, a young man who was born into a pretty privileged and well-educated family named Michio Ito, came in 1915 to Paris. He was sent by his father to study Western piano and Western singing. And he actually performed in an opera about Buddha in Germany in that period. And he lost interest in opera. And he had been, as a young boy, given instructions in kabuki. And he had, of course, knew the no drama, but didn't like it. But he saw Isadora Duncan dance, the great progenitor of modern dance. And this moved him so deeply that he started to dance. And he would perform in soirees, you know, in Paris, where very rich people, very sophisticated rich people would give small gatherings of salons, and they would perform. That's a lot of Isadora's beginnings are in that, too. And he saw Nijinsky do The Afternoon of a Faun, and this just completely shocked his brains to pieces. And so he started to dance, and his dance was to Western-style music, to Debussy's music, and to pieces like that. But it so impressed people, because apparently he used a lot of the techniques he had learned in Kabuki, that he came to the attention of William Butler Yeats through Ezra Pound. And Yeats had given up all interest in writing for the theater. And when he saw Michio Ito dance, he wanted, and also Pound was translating into English from Fenollosa. He was taking Fenollosa's work of translating the no plays into English, which were all happening in this decade, just before World War I. Yeats was reading no dramas that Pound was translating or adapting from Fenollosa's work. And this stunned Yeats. And he started to write plays. And I love his plays. I'm completely enamored of William Butler Yeats's plays. And they were their English language known. And many of them, and certainly At Hawk's Well, which is the first one he wrote, definitely was in the model of a no play. Mm. And they got Michio Ito. They said, you have to teach us everything you know about no. And he said, I don't like no. It's awful, or something to that effect. And he had only seen it once or twice as a child or something. But he created a no performance style for At Hawk's Well for Yeats, and performed the hawk in At Hawk's Well. And the result was stunning. I mean, people just couldn't believe the fusion, the excitement of the fusion of these styles.
Yeah.
And so that's really the beginning of the influence of Japanese performance styles on the Western avant-garde. Today, you have, I don't want to go too far, because I want to tell you my story about the American occupation in World War II. It's a true story that when we took over the governance of Japan in 1945, when Japan surrendered unconditionally, one of the objects of the occupation was to completely undermine the militaristic warrior ethic and Bushido code kind of mentality that they felt that the American occupation forces felt had led to this this military dictatorship in Japan. So they wanted to completely undermine that. So how do you do that? You take the art forms that the military had doted on away from them. So guess what they canceled? Kabuki. They thought Kabuki, with these big, larger-than-life warriors that swagger around and take swords and cut off the heads of 50 people at once, that's got to be bad. Mm-hmm. And we've got to kill that.
Interesting.
And they didn't realize that the Kabuki is making fun of the warrior class, and that the warrior class hated Kabuki.
Oh, interesting.
And that the merchant class, it was the peasants and the merchant class who loved the
so
Kabuki.
Stupid.
Yeah, no, it's not stupid, but it's a misreading.
Yeah.
And so what happened was the Kabuki theaters were shut down, and those Kabuki artists started starving. They had no other way to earn a living. And they also have inside of themselves this incredible tradition. But there were some people in the American occupation forces who were, of course, many who were very fluent in Japan. They took Japanese American scholars, you know, who were serving in the military, and used them as conduits in the occupation, in the 5 years of the American occupation. And so they were more sophisticated, and they saved the Kabuki families. They fed them out of their own rations, and they eventually got the occupation to allow Kabuki performances.
Okay.
But they had to teach the ruling element of the military the truth about Kabuki. It was no theater that maintained the warrior code and the Bushido code and the values of the military. And they didn't know it. And no drama was never touched by the occupation.
Too subtle and slow.
Too subtle and not popular enough.
Problematic.
And not so popular.
Interesting. That's a great little insight. Very few people know that one,
sure. But the Kabuki survived, and the influence of Japanese traditional performance arts was tremendous enrichment on the Western avant-garde, which started with Yeats and Pound, but then continued. And after World War II, some marvelous Japanese practitioners of theater, particularly Suzuki, Tadashi Suzuki, who founded a style of acting based on the no discipline and the movements of the no, which are cataloged. It's like classical ballet, where each step has a name. Each step has to be precisely and perfectly performed. That's the same in no theater. And this technique was applied to all sorts of drama. And what Suzuki did was to apply it to Greek drama. Some of his most famous productions, not all but some, in his theater at Kogo in Japan, which was an international company. People came from all over the world to study with him. He was such a famous practitioner and teacher. He took the Oresteia, he took Medea, he took some of the great classics of the Greek theater and did them in a kind of modernized, very emotionally explicit, but no-based style. So, of course, this influenced Anne Bogart, who went to Kogo and studied with him. And she's one of the greatest American directors now. And did just a couple of years ago, before COVID, I think, Iphigenia and Aulis at the Getty Theater. She's done a couple of productions at the Getty Theater in Malibu of Greek plays. And this is just the tip of the iceberg. There is continuing, just as the anime is influencing Western film, the Japanese theater continues to exert powerful, powerful influence on the theaters of the West.
A lot of cross-pollination.
Well, Catherine Free, this is just a little bit of what we could talk about, so we will continue our series. I so enjoy learning from you and hearing all these insights.
I love talking to you, Peter.
Yeah,
you bring the best out in me.
Thanks again.
We are coming to the end of the Mystic Pete Chronicles. You can reach me at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. In today's show, I interviewed the beloved Catherine Free, longtime Loyola Marymount University professor and KXLU host, and we talked about Japanese theater. We started the show at the very beginning with a piece by Ensemble Nipponia called The Pine Tree at Ataka, Ataka no Matsu. We'll be back next week with the very best of talk radio. Mystic Pete out.